This week on the BOAG World Show, we're joined by Caroline Bell, whose endless positivity and head full of plans will end this season on an inspirational high note. This week's show is brought to you by Full Story and Balsamic. Hello and welcome to BOAGworld.com, the podcast for those involved in designing, developing and running websites on a daily basis. I've gone back to an old introduction, haven't I? I don't normally do that one anymore.
Designing and stuff on a daily basis.
Where did that come from?
I don't know. It's the hot weather, Paul.
End of season.
Yeah, last one in the series and all that kind of stuff.
It feels like summer's out. Hurrah! Except all the work I've got to do tomorrow. But, you know...
I'm taking my grandchildren to the seaside tomorrow. That'll be nice. Yeah.
On a Friday? Shouldn't you be working, sir?
Well, I'm taking the day off, an official day's leave.
I don't know whether that's allowed.
I'm actually going to talk about that in a minute.
Taking time off?
Well, it's one of the aspects of my thought for the day.
Ah, I see. While you're going to the seaside, I'm going to... an Apple store because I've got a sticky keyboard.
That's the
most annoying
common thing. The G key sticks on mine.
Mine's the N key, which is really it's amazing how much, and it doesn't just stick, it just does not work now, so I've been forced into doing something about it. And what's really annoying is this is the second time I've had to do it. I've already taken it in once.
Yeah, Ian's had to do the same at our place. They're known for it. It's a common problem.
I know it is. And at least they're doing it for free, so you can't complain. Well, you can
a bit. Where have you got to go to the Apple store?
Well, it's actually not an Apple store because, Dorset, so,
Exactly, that's why I asked the question.
Exactly. As it is, I have to drive to Wiltshire in order to get help, so I've got to go to Salisbury.
So the nearest actual Apple store to you is what, Southampton? Basingstoke?
Southampton would be the nearest, yeah.
That's what comes of living out in the wilds, Paul.
And I wouldn't change it at this time of year. How long does it take you to get to the seaside tomorrow?
Oh, ages. I'm proper landlocked. The nearest place we can go that's with nice beaches, West Wittering. I mean, on a really good run, that's an hour. Yeah, it'll be more than that tomorrow.
Yeah, see,
so I'm, for you, what you're about 20 minutes, aren't you?
About that, yeah. Yeah. So, but then, as someone that had to go up to London 3 weeks on a trot, at the moment, I think I would swap with you.
Well, I've been doing the same, and we're about to kick off a project. I've actually just spoken to the guys, and they're like, "Oh, we're going on holiday. That person's going on holiday, and we've got to do some student interviews. So that'll be rubbish in August. So let's just put it all back a month." So I was going to say that I'm going to be doing the same over the next month, but I'm not.
Yeah, so it's that time of year, isn't it? Trying to arrange any kind of work at the moment turns into this logistical nightmare. I'm doing a big... I've got a really good client that, unfortunately, I'm an NDA over, so I can't actually say who it is. But it's like, okay, we want this by the end of this month. Oh, and by the way, I'm away for 2 weeks of it. What?
Yeah, they want it to happen automagically.
Yes. Yeah, so there we go. They'll get what they get then if they're not going to be around to tell me I'm doing it wrong.
Just your opinion, Paul. That's all they're paying you for anyway, so it doesn't matter.
It is true. It was really funny. This particular client, they sent through a load of previous stuff that other agencies over the years has written for them, and I'm reading through it and going... It's spot on. Everything they've written is spot on. They've had really good advice. Right. But it's like, my style is so different. I can't write like they do. It's, it's all very grown up and proper and very, very businessy. And lots of numbers and data that obviously don't mean anything. They're all just made up. But, it looks impressive. I can't do that. So there we go. But they want to work with me anyway. So, I can't be doing it entirely wrong, can I?
Oh, I mean, yeah, I'm the amount of documentation you and I have written over the years, especially the kind of long reports that you do. You know, you've got to cover a lot of stuff. You've been hired to look at a big thing, so you're going to write a lot of stuff about a big thing, aren't you? And yeah. I often wonder, you know, I mean, of course they're read once, but, you know, are they just then tucked in a drawer?
I know. And so, this, yeah. And, you know, this particular one that I'm writing, it's like I've ummed and ahed over it because it's a new big client and you're like, well, I want to impress and I'm, you know, and they've got certain expectations about what I'm going to deliver. But what they expect me to deliver actually isn't what they need. Mm. So screw it. I'm going to give them what they need. And if I never get to work with them again, then so be it. You can't end up writing just to please the client rather than telling them what they need to hear. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. It goes back to that kind of what the approach that the guy from AJ and Smart have about making it all kind of very workshop-like. And don't worry too much about the user research. We'll kind of just test it later. I mean, maybe that's too far. It's too much of an extreme. Because I actually quite like reviewing sites and coming up with recommendations and that kind of stuff. But if you're doing it more hands-on, face-to-face, I think maybe it's more likely to be taken on board and you know, things are brainstormed together, so they're more likely to happen. Is kind of
Yeah, because I can't help but feel like this company has had enough reports. Do you know what I mean? They now need to just, you know, let's make some of this happen. But the trouble is, a lot of the reports that they've received are all recommendations, right? You should do this, and you should do that, and you should do the other, which is all great, but they don't really know how to do that effectively, and they don't know what order to do it in, and they haven't got the right mechanisms in place to actually achieve these things. So there's no good having a load of recommendations if you can't actually do any of them because you're not set up to do them. And so that's the little rant I'm going to go on. So I'm not really writing a report, more of a rant, a 10,000 word rant.
Well, that'll catch their attention anyway.
It will. But of course, I've got to write the whole thing without an N key. So that'll be interesting.
Oh, that'd be really hard.
Yeah.
You'd have to stop every third word, wouldn't you?
My notes for this show say that the next thing that I have to discuss is Ext Caesar.
Yeah, and you said, and your note to me before we started was, I'm ready, I can do this, ow, I think it said.
Yeah. That's the world I live in now. So anyway, what I'm supposed to be talking about, I'm guessing Ext Caesar is actually next season. Because this is the last one for this season.
It is. What are we doing next season, Paul?
This is the fact, and you think, dear listener, that Marcus is saying that because, you know, to laterally lead on to the conversation. It's because he actually doesn't know. You've no idea, have you, what we're covering next season. We never even discuss it, do we?
I think you did mention something two or three episodes ago, but that was two or three episodes ago. So much has happened since.
I know. Life's just so busy, isn't it?
You'll say it, and I'll go, I remember.
Maybe. Encouraging clicks. Does that help remind you?
Yes, it's all about your brainwashing techniques. That's what we're going to talk about next season, isn't it?
Say it. I've specifically. So basically, I'm releasing this course, aren't I?
You are.
This five hours worth. Which, by the way, I want to kill myself at this point. 5 hours worth of video recorded material on encouraging clicks. And the whole thing is titled An Ethical Guide to Persuasion. So you then call it brainwashing techniques, which is harsh, Marcus.
You set them up, I'll knock them down.
Exactly. So so we're going to be doing that. I hate, my problem is I hate producing stuff, right? And I know I should write, you know, yes, you should sell your knowledge. People should buy it. Right. And I know that's right. And I know I'm going to sell this course. But then I have this overwhelming thing of, well, not many people are going to get to see it then. And I've put a lot of effort into this. So what I end up doing is giving away big chunks of it. It's like,
which kind of makes sense. I mean, that's how most people sell these days, isn't it? By kind of giving away their knowledge, and you know, that might mean that they want to work with you in the future or something. So
and obviously we can't cover all of that material in the next season. And also, of course, people know that, you know, this is the podcast, and so you know that anything that's going to be discussed on this isn't going to be presented in the orderly, nice, professional way that the course is. No, it's going to be constantly interrupted by Marcus making snide comments the whole time. So,
it's harsh.
Well, you've already made snide comments about it, and we haven't even started it yet.
Just the one. I'm normally very, very pleasant to be around, and I say nice things, Paul.
So it's a long season next season. It starts, it starts August 16th. We're going to kick off, and it's going to run all the way through to Christmas. Well, almost Christmas.
Okay, that's about 20 episodes.
Yeah, when I say all the way to Christmas, I mean the 22nd of November, which isn't Christmas at all, is it? It's 15 episodes long, all right? Okay, and then we're going to have a really long Christmas break, I've decided.
That sounds nice.
It almost makes it sound like this show is a hardship to do, doesn't it?
it isn't, but this season I've had to come up with things, which is quite hard.
Do you think... how many times have I done that? My wife's waving at me. What she doesn't realise is I'm recording a podcast. Hello.
Hello, Kath.
How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
Yeah, Marcus says hello.
Hello, Marcus.
All right, there you go.
Yeah.
So... She's so much happier since she's stopped transcribing the show.
Oh, I think that is one of the forms of hell. It's got to
I
be.
Know. But the irony is, this is so funny, right? So she stopped transcribing the show a little while ago. And then, you know, we had this long conversation. And we want to involve Kath in the business now. James is back off to sixth form college, so he doesn't need homeschooling anymore. You know, we've got, the house renovation project is done. So she's got time and she wants to start building up a career. And she's got a lot of experience in, like, governance and that kind of stuff from when she used to work. So mm-hmm. perfect to work alongside. But obviously she's got to get up to speed. There's a lot that she has to learn and all the rest of it. She's come on as my intern. That's not working. But the irony is the very first job she had to do was a load of video editing of me doing this course that I'm doing. So she's like, she stops doing the transcription and now has to listen to me and watch me spouting crap.
That's hard. That's tough. You're a hard taskmaster, Paul. But, you know, she's learning quickly, I'm sure.
Well, of course, that is going to make you
learn to edit stuff really quickly, isn't it, in her case?
Yeah. She'll get really fast at editing. But it also means she has to listen to me, which she never does in any other area of our lives. So it means that she might learn some stuff. Oh, thank goodness she's not going to hear this.
That's the nice thing
about her not transcribing the show. Anyway, all of this, we've spent over 10 minutes now. You've obviously got me in a talkative mood, and we haven't actually done your thought for the day yet, and that's the really important part. You don't think you're getting out of this next season, do you?
I have already set myself a weekly task of coming up with a thought for the day.
Oh, I'm so glad, because we haven't talked about whether you're going to do it next season. I really want you to. So it's good to have, you know, a different perspective, because I can sit back and I can learn from you, which is nice. Go on then. What's your thought for the day?
Right. This one is about managing a team running an agency, but it's more managing a team and trying to, in brackets, managing a happy team. And obviously, I don't want to come across as if I assume that's what I'm doing, but I hope we're managing to... manage a fairly happy team, and these are the sort of a few points that we try to adhere to make that happen. So that's what
they talk about. They must be reasonably happy, because nobody ever leaves.
They don't. No one's left for a long, long time. So yeah,
it does help that you hobble them like they used to do to slaves, you know, where they can't actually run away because they've been hobbled.
Yeah, they'll have balls and chains around their ankles.
Yeah, absolutely.
Anyway, right, so a few things that I'll just talk about. So working hours is one mm-hmm. that you need. We feel you need to be quite flexible about. Mm-hmm. You can't be too flexible, because if you make it so, yeah, you just need to do 8 hours or whatever whenever you feel like it, then you end up with a team that some people work in the middle of the night and some people work in the middle mm-hmm. of the day, etc., and nobody ever talks to each other. So we have got kind of a crossover period of maybe say 10 till 4 or 10 till 3, something like that, where we expect people to be working so that they can communicate with each other. But otherwise, yeah, you can kind of, you know, as long as you get the work done, come and go when it suits you, mm-hmm. which is... we think kind of helpful, and also we don't get sort of fretty if you've got a doctor's appointment and things like that. And I know that a lot of companies do, or they did when I used to work in big places. So yeah, just treat people like adults, I suppose, and then hopefully they'll treat you well back. The other one is, and this is connected with that, is allowing people to work from home. Mm-hmm. My favourite way of working is about 50-50, or maybe 40% office, 60% at home. And that seems to work for us as a business quite well, although Ian and Lee, they work miles away, so they kind of come in every 2 or 3 weeks and spend a couple of days with us. And that seems to work very well. People seem to like that a lot. Working environment is another one. It seems to me that the way that people work in kind of modern companies that are digitally transformed, that people don't have their own space, that you hot desk and stuff like that. I really don't like that. I think it's important either. To give people their own desk that they can make their own. So we do that. I don't know why that's the thing these days, but anyway.
Well, it's more efficient, isn't it? I mean, there is some... well, because you can... I don't understand. I think it works out better if people move around and it's more flexible and cheaper or something. I don't know. But the only thing I would say in favour of hot desking is the fact that it does mean that you can, you know, go and sit. I mean, it doesn't apply at somewhere as small as Headscape, because you all sit in the same room anyway. But at a larger organisation, it does mean that, because the problem I often come across is that, you know, teams are spread over multiple floors, and, you know, so you end up with IT on one floor, you end up with marketing on another and design at another, and that kind of fosters a kind of slight distrust of each other. And so these people are supposedly all working together to achieve whatever project, but they're not really, because they're spread over multiple floors. At least if they're hot desking, they can move and sit with one another. But that only applies at big organisations, not like somewhere like Headscape.
Yeah, and I kind of get it. I suppose if you've got a team of 10 people all in one block, who've been there for years, there could almost like be a wall around them, couldn't there? So from that point of view, I kind of get that, yeah. But I think people like to have their own space, so...
Yes, I agree with that, absolutely.
The other one is work quality and diversity, and I've written this down in the kind of like, that's what we're
aiming
for.
Hang on a minute. Diversity. Headscape. It's got, what is it, one female employee?
No. The diversity of the work we do.
Oh, okay. I thought you meant in people. I thought you were about to kind of, you know, claim that it's really important that you've got a ethnic diversity and a diversity of gender and that kind of stuff. No women want to work with Headscape. They never have.
That's not true, Paul. On that subject, we'll let's go there. Yes, we should be more diverse than we are, and we would like to be.
I know. Well, at least there was one stage where we had no women working with us.
Correct.
I don't count Kath when she worked with us.
You're just digging it even further now.
Why not? Why not? I'm at that, you know. She doesn't listen to it. I'm fine.
Yeah, you're okay. But anyway, yes, so trying to provide sort of interesting and different types of work, and we can't always do that, but we do try, and we try to kind of... Basically, Headscape is two teams. So like it's a team that can do... One team can do a project, and number two team can do another project, and we kind of try and make sure that they all get mixed up and people get a kind of... you know, if one person has done a big American-related project, then we'll make sure that the other team gets to do that the next time round. The other thing we try and do, we don't always stick to this, but is to have fixed days. So we have a fixed day every week where we kind of do all the little bits and bobs so that they don't kind of get in the way of the bigger project work again.
Sometimes that's a really good idea.
But it does, it generally it's a good thing. Holidays is the next one. I think this has been generally seen as a very bad idea, but it was trendy about 2 or 3 years ago that trendy companies were saying to people, yeah, you can just choose when you go on holiday, which I think is crap.
Hang on a minute. Yeah, I think you need to clarify that. You don't mean choose, because obviously people can choose when they go on holiday. You mean that they had unlimited holiday.
Unlimited holiday, yes, that's what I mean. Yeah,
which is code for if you leave the office, you're going to be guilted into the fact that you've taken holiday.
Exactly. So what we try and do is we give extra holiday for long service. And as you've already pointed out, Paul, nobody ever leaves. So pretty much everybody's got the full amount of holiday now. And this was the point relating to my day tomorrow, is I don't think directors should take the piss. It'd be very, very easy for me to just go, I'm not working tomorrow. But I think it's important that we're seen as being, you know, part of the same process that everybody else goes through. So I have booked my day tomorrow.
The other thing that I think is worth saying on that one is I've known Headscape actually have to persuade people to take time off.
Yes.
And I think that's I'm glad that we do that at Headscape, that we, you know, that we say, look, actually take your holiday, because it's not good for people just to keep going and going and going. The whole time, even if they don't want to take a break, they should be made to.
Yes.
Nanny state.
Encourage people to do that, yes.
Yeah.
You don't order them. Anyway, no, final 2 points are about get-togethers, sort of work-related ones. I mean, this kind of goes in waves with us, and this idea of kind of like everyone coming together and talking about new stuff or what they're working on and that kind of thing. We're not really doing that at the moment. I imagine we probably will again in 6 months' time. But we do always have noodles on Tuesday lunchtimes, which is a nice thing.
Because we always used to play ball when we were in the barn, and that was always a nice little thing that we did together. It's good to have a thing you do together, isn't it?
Exactly, yes. And social, I think it's important, but we're fairly rubbish at this. I think it's because we live so far apart from each other. But I think it is important to see each other on a social level. Christmas we always do pretty well. And now we start to celebrate project completions, which is a nice thing as well. So
I like that idea. That's a good idea.
Although one thing that came up on this is the very final point. It was on the Berg World Slack channel about somebody was saying that a friend of theirs was effectively being forced to go out and these kind of like work related socials, you know, very sort of alcohol fueled type things. And they were sort of more introverted and felt very uncomfortable about it. So you need to be careful on these things, but yeah, it doesn't hurt once in a while, I think, for everyone to get together.
Yeah.
And that's it.
Yeah. You are right about that. If you're going to have it, you know, if you're going to really strongly encourage people to do that kind of thing, it needs to be the right kind of environment where those people that aren't so outgoing get to not be so outgoing. And that's a really good one. That was my favourite thought for the day so far. You're getting better and better at this, Marcus. Well done.
Pleasure.
A star.
Cheers. Oh, yeah. Pat on the back.
Yeah. Do you feel suitably patronised?
Absolutely, massively so. But I'm going to keep smiling. No, I'm quite enjoying it. It's making me think, and that's always a good thing for my old brain.
Do you know, seriously, that's why, you know, why I've kept blogging for so long. You know, one of the things, you know, people often say to me, how do you keep doing this week in and week out? You know, and a lot of people give up blogging because, you know, nobody's reading it. What's the point? But I don't blog for people reading it. Don't get me wrong, I love the fact that people read my stuff, but I blog because it helps me think things through, you know, and consider stuff. So yeah, I totally get it. All right, let's talk about our first sponsor, which is Full Story. Thank you guys at Full Story so much for you're just such amazing support. I'm almost embarrassed. I'm thinking about the next season and it's like, do I go back to them and ask them again? That's kind of a bit embarrassing, really. But on the other hand, it's kind of rude if you don't, you know. So I feel like that about balsamic as well.
You have to.
Do I? I don't know. It's like difficult, isn't it? So, yes, Full Story. But they've been brilliant at supporting the show, and it is the best session recorder out there. You know, screw Hotjar or whatever. I'm probably not allowed to say that. That's a very inappropriate thing to say.
I will be. Sorry, I've got to. This is a relevant interruption. I'm going to be doing some session recorder analysis from another third-party supplier, so I'll report back on how that goes when it happens.
Yeah. Okay, that's interesting. It'd be quite interesting. I wonder if we could persuade the Full Story guys ever do sponsor the show again. And I, you know, if they don't, I completely understand that. But to actually maybe get their sponsor slots to be giving some little tips and advice about how to get the most out of session recorders and do that kind of analysis, that'd be really interesting, wouldn't it? I quite like that idea.
Yeah,
it would be. Anyway, so Full Story. We all know what session recorders do and that they let you watch back a user's session. Incredibly useful for getting natural user behavior and getting insights into that. But some recorders that shall now remain nameless, even though I've just named them, I find them very overwhelming, that you get so many sessions, but it's hard to kind of find the sessions that are actually useful to you and that tell you what you want. And also in some of them, and I don't know, I have no idea whether this is true with the aforementioned example I gave, but with some of them, you have to plan ahead in order to gather the data. So you have to like set up event handlers and all that kind of stuff. Full Story solves those issues because it records every session, meaning that you don't have to plan ahead. You can search on almost anything. From, you know, what text people click on to what DOM, even down to what DOM elements they're interacting with. And so that means you can easily find specifically what you're after. It'll even track things like moments of frustration, like rage clicks, which is always very funny to watch, where people suddenly just kind of freak out and go, why isn't this working? And start clicking repeatedly. It's not funny if it's your site. It's only funny if it's somebody else's site. So you can sign up today and you can get a free month of the pro account. No need to enter a credit card or anything annoying like that. If you get to the end of the month and you want to carry on, then great, no problem. If you don't want to carry on, you can still get 1,000 sessions per month for free. Just go to fullstory.com/ Boag, and just give it a go. It's fascinating, even if you're never intending to spend money with them. Not that I said that, because that would be bad. All right, let's talk about our interview to today. This interview, just I sat there grinning from beginning to end. So Caroline Bell, I met when I was doing an e-consultancy workshop. I regularly do e-consultancy workshops, and she came along to one. She's from a company called Elvive, that are a insurance company here in the UK, and she was just so positive and upbeat in our meeting, but also I thought that in the workshop, and I just thought she'd be such a great person to get on the show. And sure enough, we get her on this podcast, and she's so like, oh, you know, we could do this, we could do that. She's so upbeat and positive, despite the fact that, you know, it's quite a hard environment to work in. Not that the company's hard, but the financial sector, there's so many rules and regulations, it can be quite frustrating. But anyway, check out this interview with Caroline, and I'm sure you'll agree that she's a bit of a star, really, a bit of inspiration. Here you go. Hello Caroline, thank you so much for agreeing to be on the show. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
So we thought a good place to start would be maybe you tell us a little bit about your role at Elvive, and maybe a bit about the company as well.
Yeah, sure. So my title is Digital Experience Architect, which sounds slightly vague and doesn't really explain exactly what I do, but essentially what I do is I work on all UX things related. So my work varies from getting involved on different projects that require UX research. So getting involved in creating personas, carrying out all that research prior to creating those personas, user testing, user journey mapping. And also on the back of that, I do a lot of the UX design. So designing solutions up in wireframes, running workshops, prototypes, and all of those things.
Mm-hmm.
And so your second question was about how we're set
just
up.
Just a bit. No. Before we even kind of get into that, I think just for people that don't know what LV do, and, you know, it'd be useful to know a little bit about the company.
Yeah, sure. So I think a lot of people think that LV is purely insurance, and mm-hmm. it is what we mainly do. So general insurance, such as car, home, motorbike, caravan. But we also have the other side of the business where we work on other products such as life insurance. We offer retirement and pension advice, and also advice in pension in investments as well.
Okay. Oh, that's interesting to know. I didn't realize that you did quite that broad a range of stuff. And obviously there's a lot of people listening to this show that are outside of the UK and so might not have come across you as a company before. So
sure.
You mentioned there very briefly about this idea of how you're organized and structured as a company. So what team are you a part of? Where do you sit in the company?
So I sit within a digital team. So mm-hmm. within the digital team, there's about, I'll probably say, 40 to 50 people within the wider digital team. And then that team is broken down into sub-teams, and my team is the UX team.
Mm-hmm.
And within the UX team, we've got UX designers, a new UX researcher, which is great, and the UX manager heads up that team.
Okay, right, that makes sense. And the digital team sits within what?
So just if we take a step back slightly so I can help you sure. answer this question.
Yeah, that's fine.
The company is kind of split into two, if you like. We've got the general insurance side of the business. So you've got, like I said, the car, motor, those sorts of general insurance products. And then the other side of the business, we've got our life insurance, we've got retirement and pensions, we've got investments. So I mm-hmm. sit in that life side of the business.
Okay.
And within that side of the business, we've got a digital team that consists of people who work within the content, so making updates and changes and creating new pages within the CMS system. You've got the marketing team, work on their campaigns, and you've obviously got the UX team, as I mentioned before. Mm-hmm. And that team, they're a support team, a customer member support team, to that wider life business. So any digital propositions, anything that we can help in terms of explaining or selling the life digital products, we support that side of the business.
Sure. Okay. And is there a separate digital team for the other side of the business?
Exactly. Yeah, there is. Right. So we're in the general insurance. They've got their own digital team, and within that digital team they've got their UX team. I wouldn't say it exactly mirrors in terms of the structure on the general insurance to the other life side of the business. There are slight differences in terms of how they're set up, mm-hmm. but they do both recognize on each side of the business the importance of UX, mm-hmm. and it has that UX team has grown within those digital teams on both sides of the business.
Okay. And how much do you have to do with the UX team on the other side of the business?
Historically, it's always been quite separate.
Okay.
But there has been a recent project that I have been involved in, which meant that we needed to collaborate on. Mm-hmm. And I have worked very, very closely actually to the other side of the business, and it's been great, because obviously with systems thinking coming in and being more collaborative in the way that we work together, it's been a great experience, and there's been many learnings about the culture, about how their teams are set up, and about systems and practices and processes that I've learned just from mixing and collaborating with the other side of the team. Yeah.
So that's worked well. You've enjoyed that experience of getting to work with this another group of UX people?
Definitely. Yeah. I think that if there's any opportunity that we can work more collaboratively to gain more insight into the culture and into different practices and processes that they've tried, they've experienced, that have worked well. So it's great learnings that, you know, that we could benefit from. Absolutely. Mm.
Are they targeting a different audience to you, or is it quite similar, the audience both groups are reaching?
So with the general insurance, yes, it is different. So they're targeting people of a different demographic. So for example, right, usually 45 plus, but also in their behavior as well, it's very different. It's very quick. We get a lot of audience obviously coming through from our aggregator sites on the general insurance side of the business as well. So there's that factor too, but their behavior again is very much, it's very different. In terms of there's a quick kind of e-commerce type of approach there, whereas the life side of the business, it's the way that we target customers is more around their behavior in wanting to research more about the products, because the products on the life side are very different. It's more about providing a service, and the service is financial advice. Therefore, users need to understand, and we will try to explain that, the benefits of advice and how it can enhance their pensions, for example, and how we can help them create better decisions with their finances. So it's more about guiding and coaching and therefore providing all that rich information as opposed to making a quick purchase. So because there's different needs from the different products, therefore it's a different audience, and obviously demographics are different, especially with the retirement and investments. You're targeting a much a higher age group, so you're looking at 55 plus really.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, there's something that immediately sprang to my mind when you were just speaking there. You know, we're offering financial advice, right? My instant reaction was, I bet you spend a lot of time fighting with compliance and legal restrictions placed on you. Is that proved a challenge?
Yes. I think that anyone who works for any financial company, there are a lot of restrictions. It's not to say that we have a bad relationship with compliance, because we don't. Because ultimately, we're aiming for the same place. We want to offer a good customer experience. We want to be able to provide them the right information at the right time, in order for them to make a wise and good decision. So ultimately, we're aiming for the same thing. But obviously, we are kind of we're taken back a little bit. So I think the way I see it is that we, as a UX team, we provide and we design solutions for optimal experiences, and we come up with these lovely designs and everything. But we get scaled back. We get scaled back, obviously, by compliance. And examples of this could be that we can't say certain things, or we have to include lots and lots of T's and C's on the website. So we have to, as a team, think about how we can deal with that. How do we deal with all of this content that we need to provide on the website without taking users away from having a good, simplified user experience? So we need to balance that quite cleverly, I guess, in order to provide a good experience for users and not baffle them with so much information at the same time as well.
Yeah. I mean, you said something quite interesting there, which is that we create the perfect user experience and then scale it back. I think, is the right way round to do it. I see a lot of companies that, the UX designer sits there and goes, well, there's no point in me even trying to do that because, you know, I'll never get past legal and compliance. They never, they're kind of self-censoring. And I often find that, you know, if you've got a good legal and compliance department, which sounds like you guys have, you can kind of work out compromises together. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and that's exactly what we're trying to do. I think it's within our team, we're all quite ambitious. We all want to change things. We know things aren't perfect. We want to make things better. That's where we all come from. And that's why we always try to create these experiences and these wireframes and prototypes that we're really proud of. But we kind of are not naive, thinking it's going to get to get better, but it doesn't mean that we can't stop trying. So we push their boundaries, but I think that they enjoy the challenge.
Yeah, and it should be a good working relationship. I mean, you said right at the beginning, which I thought was a nice thing to say, that you know you're after the same thing, and you know you don't see them as the enemy. And I do think a lot of people get into that mindset of seeing legal and compliance as the enemy, when actually they're just trying to do their job. You know, they're trying to pick through what can be a very complicated and messy situation, because a lot of legislation really lacks definition in terms of practical application. And so, you know, it's a really challenging role, I always think.
Absolutely.
So the other thing that you said earlier, which I thought was quite interesting, is you described yourself as a service department to help deliver on the products and services that other people within the organization are trying to promote, right? So you've got these parts of the business that are the product owners. I'm quite interested in the working relationship there. How does that work? How restrictive is their brief to you? How early in the process do you get involved, etc.?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So at the moment, as it currently stands, we get briefed in from different areas of the business on various kind of digital requirements. So when they come in, that's when we liaise with the project managers, and they look at what areas are required. So how much UX input is required, how much content, how much marketing, blah, 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 blah. So that's how it currently is set up. And I'm quite an advocate of getting involved much earlier on. So being very much a central part of the business. And so when propositions are created, we are part of that, thinking from the user experience from the very, very beginning. Not just at the end thinking, oh, can we just put some UX stuff on the end of that, please? You know, and I get that, and the interactivity on the website is important, obviously, but also not necessarily more importantly, but the other part of that is to think about, you know, is this something that users actually want? Who are the actual users that we're speaking to? Is there a gap in the market for this? All of those kind of questions at the very, very beginning, we need to be a part of that. We need to be involved and actually play a big part in that. And that's something I'm quite keen on pushing, and I'm quite an advocate of being very much part of that centralized part of the business.
And what kind of reaction are you getting to those kinds of suggestions? You know, are people open to you being involved earlier? Is it literally a time constraint? Why perhaps hasn't that happened?
I think it's probably user experiences. It's fairly new to some people. You know, not everyone is aware of the whole industry. There is that. There's the whole the thing about the digital team in itself, that, you know, and we get comments such as, you know, you just colour in boxes. Is that what you do as a digital team? And they do the serious stuff, which is provide financial advice. So we there's that kind of attitude still that we get. But in terms of being open as a business, I have to say for a corporate environment and working for a financial company, they are more open to change and to innovation than I expected. It's not completely, absolutely no way, Caroline, we cannot do that. It's okay, this is an interesting idea, Caroline. Let's see what we can do. And it's very much to say, okay, well, this is a really great idea, but can you put a plan? Can you put a strategy? Can you put a business case together in order to make this happen? And And that's kind of the response I get. But you know, it's when you have that time, these things, they're not a quick. It's not something that I can do by myself. It's something that we have to do as a team. And I have to obviously get my seniors within my digital team to actually to believe in that as well, as much as I believe in it too. So those are the kind of challenges I get, and I think that I absolutely have put strategies together, but then obviously it's putting it into place. And when you've got your day-to-day jobs, it's you don't always have that time. And another project's come in, you know how it goes. And so in terms of how we've progressed with that, I would say that the awareness is there now. It's just a case of like of putting it into practice and getting everyone on board to do that. But I think it's going to be time as well. Before that actually happens.
I like your attitude towards it. You're not being unrealistic in it. You're recognizing that this takes time, that changing a culture takes time. And I also like the way that you describe and talk about your colleagues, you know, that you're not describing them as resistant or being difficult or awkward. You're framing it in terms of, well, they just don't really understand it yet. And I love that. You know, because I find, you know, I encounter so many UX people, and I can understand this, that have kind of got trodden down. Does that make sense? You know, and they found that battle tiring, and they just got to the point of seeing everybody else as the enemy. And it's very difficult to bring about change once you get into that mindset. So I think you're in a great place, and I think that's really encouraging. And I love the fact that there is that, you know, willingness to consider doing things differently. They just need it explaining to them, and that's fair enough, isn't it? Really, can't really argue with that.
yeah, and I think as part of being involved in UX, it very much is about communication. You have to get along with your colleagues. I mean, part of your job is you're selling yourself as a UX specialist. And with that, you have to have communication skills. You have to have those influential skills, not just with you know, finding good experience for users, but it's everyone around you, within your digital team, within your wider business. We need to sell UX. We need to be the advocates of it. And with that, you have to have those communication skills, because otherwise, I personally don't know how far you would get without that.
Absolutely. It always amuses me, you know, how good we are as UX professionals at empathizing with the end user and communicating and speaking with the end user. But as soon as we start talking about our own internal stakeholders, suddenly our empathy goes out the window and we turn into these grumpy asses, basically.
I mean, don't get me wrong. It's not all nice as pie. I mean, you have conflicts, but that's just natural. Whereas you've got a big company, you've got politics, and there is politics there. Well, like I imagine every company does. When you've got a lot of colleagues, so it's not without its problems. But I mean, I think our problems are very similar to other big corporate companies. But you know, it's just a matter of seeing the bigger picture and seeing actually what is it at hand that's the issue here. And then you write all the things and you're like, actually, what does it all come to? It comes to just a misunderstanding and unawareness. That's all it is. And if I can get over that, then I could be in a much better place. So that's how I see it.
It sounds like almost your biggest barrier in some ways is having time to educate people, time to put together these strategy documents and that kind of stuff. Is that a fair assessment?
Absolutely, yeah, spot on.
Yeah. I mean, that's such a common problem in so many organisations, that you know, they run staff at such a high level of engagement. They want to be as efficient as possible, that you don't actually have time for planning with the future. It's always that kind of short term work.
Yeah. Time is always an issue. The BAU stuff that comes in from day to day, it's just, you know, you could barely fit it in within your working hours. And to do the strategy and the business case, it's very much do it in your own time.
Yeah. It's frustrating, isn't it? But very, very common across all organisations. So another thing that I wanted to pick up on was you just talked about your digital team and you ran through the different kind of groups within it. You didn't mention developers. Do they sit separately elsewhere?
So this has been a bit of a problem, actually. We don't have, we have two developers that have just joined. They're front-end developers, but we don't have any back-end developers. So this is something that's recognised as an issue, and we are working on that. So I know on the other side of the business, in general insurance, their setup is very different. They've got a large development team. This is where I said they don't quite mirror each other on different sides of the business. So I think that there is definitely a recognised need for them, and that will change in the near future.
Because I think that's a really smart move from you guys to get developers as part of the team, because you just want everybody kind of sitting together and working together. Are you relying on outside developers at the moment, or are they just in a different team somewhere?
So we do have developers in a different team. We actually sit in a different office, and they provide development support for the whole business, not just for our digital team. So in terms of getting developers, it's absolutely just the collaboration of sitting down with developers saying, can we do this change? It's just so much quicker and easier. The communication is so much easier. It's down to money. But in terms of answering your question, yes, we have been outsourcing with development projects. We do at the moment have obviously our CMS system. We can do all the edits ourselves on the CMS system. So that can all be done in-house. It's more to do any new projects, new initiatives that cannot be done within the content management system. Then we outsource all of that stuff.
Okay, right. That makes sense. Well, I mean, I think that's a good ambition to bring that into the team. And talking of ambitions, what are there other things that you would like to do but maybe haven't managed to yet? What if you could wave a magic wand and kind of do what you wanted in the company, what would you do differently?
Well, so many things, actually.
All right, start listening.
So first of all, with the structure of the teams, I kind of wanted to get more of a balance in the types of UX specialist skills. So, for example, we heavily were on UX designers. So I wanted to bring in more UX researchers into the team. A lot of what I saw when I first joined the team was a lot of wireframes and prototypes, but not so much of that UX research to drive some of those designs. So I really wanted to get that balance with more UX researchers into the team. Obviously developers as well, we needed to get that balance. I wanted, obviously, like we've spoken to before, getting that centralized position within the company to be part of the project at the very beginning as opposed to just fixing things at the end. I wanted to improve our practices and processes to get much more streamlined, so we can do testing, so UX testing, A/B testing, and work collaboratively with the data analysts to come up with solutions, but a lot more quicker, a lot more slicker. So I really wanted to get that streamlined, so we can get into a good place in terms of making improvements to our digital assets. What else was that? I wanted to speak more, be more of an advocate across the business, to talk about what we do, but also the outcomes of what we do. So all of that hard work that we know that we've done, while they think that we're just colouring in boxes, I wanted to show what that was, get some stats there to actually say that from colouring in boxes, this is actually what we've achieved. We've actually improved customer experience rates. We've actually improved the revenue by so much percentage. I wanted to do much more about how the value of user experience can have within a company. So, and also just general things like when I said practice the process, I want to create our new toolkits, and I want to create a new asset place where we can basically an online forum where we can be a lot more consistent with the way that we design things, the way that, so for example, our methods of research. I wanted to have an online area where we can use that, so we could all come from the same place. So like I mentioned before, we are two businesses within one. I wanted to create that consistency between the two businesses, and I think an online place where we can hold all of our information about UX would be fantastic. Also, I wanted to start a schedule of usability insights. So everything that we measure, so everything from data, everything from user testing results, A/B testing, so everything that has come in and stuff that we've changed on the back of that, we start recording. So we're learning from all of our insights and learn from our mistakes and continue this this test and learn approach. So all of that I kind of wanted and would like to do. And I don't think any of those things are unachievable. I think that within time, I think they are possible. It's just a case of, you know, proving some of these things, the value of these things, and then speaking to the right people at the right time so we can push these things forward.
Yeah, that is a fabulous list. I couldn't agree more with absolutely everything on that list. It was very good. I mean, you're right. It's about patience. It's about perseverance and those kinds of things. How do you decide which of that list to focus on first, you know, or next, should I say? Is it just gut reaction, or do you have some kind of secret master plan somewhere?
I don't have a secret master plan. I think I'm working on a big project at the moment that will be wrapped up in the next 2 weeks, and I think this will give me time to kind of put some of those things I had in my strategy forward. And in terms of where I'll start, I'll probably think about the quick wins first. So looking at getting like a style library and putting together some of those toolboxes online, like those are quick wins. And I think that we can also prove the value of them quite quickly as well. So I'll probably start there. In terms of changing the culture and changing attitudes in regards to UX and, you know, maybe putting articles out or doing other things to create awareness, those things will take longer to do. So I'd probably, you know, do them after. But I think it's anything that we can do to obviously that's a quick win for us, but also that will see an impact to create a better experience for users. That would also be where I also start first as well. So if we can start streamlining our practices and processes, if we can start doing our schedule for regular user testing, that stuff, I can see the benefits quite quickly, I think.
And also, what I loved about those ones that you picked out there is they've got several benefits to them. One is that, as you say, they're quick wins. They're quite easy to implement. Two, you don't really need anybody else's permission to do those kinds of things. It doesn't have a wide impact. It's more about your own working processes and practices. Three, you know, there is measurable returns on all of those things. You can see the impact that they have in terms of efficiency and quality of work, which is great. And the one thing about introducing regular usability testing as well is it quickly begins to expose other people in the organization to some of the challenges that users face. So it's a totally agree with you on that. It's a really good list. Sounds like you've got an exciting time ahead.
Very much so. Yeah, I feel like I've got the energy and I've got the drive to really kind of to make these changes now. So I'm actually quite excited, and I also think that, like I mentioned before, that LV as a company, I think they are quite open to change, and I think, you know, as you know, a lot of companies are going through this digital transformation period where recognizing that they need to get on top of this, that all these new digital technologies coming out and expectations are rising and all these fintech startups are doing all these amazing things. And I think that it's waking people up a little bit, like, yeah, we need to get on top of this.
Yeah, absolutely. I've got to ask one last question, right? Which is, how long have you been at LV?
It's coming up to 2.5 years.
Right. See, you said something very interesting that grabbed my attention then, which is you say, I've got the energy to do this, right?
Yeah.
I find the longer someone is at a company, the more they kind of get sapped of their enthusiasm and drive. How do you keep going? Because you seem, you seem very upbeat about it. Are you just pretending for the interview, or are you really, really are still that enthusiastic?
I do actually think I'm that enthusiastic. I guess I've had a few good opportunities at LV. And that has been great. This last project I've worked on has been fantastic. I have learned an incredible amount. So I guess I have that loyalty to the company because I've been lucky to have those opportunities. And also I've met some brilliant people who have become my mentors actually within the business. And they've been incredible. From a UX perspective, they've offered like lots of support and encouragement. And I think that's great because, you know, when you have one of those days, you feel so frustrated and you're like, oh, I don't know why I bother. I try so hard. And then they just pick you back up again, which is great. All that emotional support that you need to keep you going. I think I would always be an advocate of having a good mentor because they definitely help me through. But I guess sometimes I just see the bigger picture, I think. I just think that I see that other companies are like this. I'm not naive to think that other companies don't go through similar experiences or UX practitioners don't go through similar things. I mean, you know, I read stuff and I listen to people who work in the UX field and I hear very similar things. So I think I have that wider awareness of that too.
And that does make an enormous difference. And that's why I'm so grateful you've come on. And I think you're the last person that I'm speaking to this season. And I'm absolutely over the moon with this conversation because you've been very open and very honest and very real about it. And people need to hear that. You know, some of the previous interviews that I've done have been brilliant and really informative, but they're kind of a league ahead. Do you know what I mean? They're operating in these incredibly, you know, highly UX focused organizations, and people interviews like that can leave you feeling a little depressed, can't they? Oh, I wish we were in that kind of situation. Yeah. While you're in a much more real situation where most people are at. So absolutely great. Thank you so much for coming on. And best of luck launching this new project, whatever it is, in the next couple of weeks and with your plans for the future.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you having me on. I was really excited to come into your show. As you know, I'm a big fan of yours. So thank you very much.
So there you go. That's the interview with Caroline. Very enthusiastic. Lots of great ideas. I love her vision for the future. She might not have been able to do all of it now, but she's certainly got a solid plan in her head of where she wants to go and a really positive plan. What did you think, Marcus?
A few little points. One, it surprised me that there wasn't more kind of interaction between the two teams. I know it's kind of like two different businesses, but you'd think there would be kind of some kind of financial wins for the company to kind of have them merged a bit more, but maybe they'll get there with that one. I've got a kind of just a general thought for the series. And the thing, and I mentioned this way back, I think it was the IBM one. What I've taken from this is that designers / UX people now wield a ton of power and therefore need managerial skills as much as their design skills.
Totally agree with that. And by managerial, I don't know whether managerial is even the right word anymore. It's leadership skills, isn't it?
Yeah, that's what I meant, yeah.
Yeah.
I just used the wrong word.
Well, it's not really. It depends on your definition of manager. It basically, it dates you, Marcus. Talking about manager, yes. I mean, that's so old-fashioned. You wouldn't get a manager in a trendy startup. There'd be a ninja leader or something, wouldn't they?
Yeah.
A unicorn.
Which is better?
I don't know. Obviously, a ninja leader slash unicorn is better.
Obviously, Paul. Yes.
Obviously. Yeah, it's been a good season. To be honest, I've got to confess, this season was pretty much for me because I wanted to nose at what was going on in lots of companies, and it gives you a good excuse to do it. Everybody that's been on the show have been such good sports and talked very openly and honestly. So let's talk about Backswimming. This podcast has now turned into Marcus Technical Support. I don't know whether you remember, but a couple of weeks ago you were going, oh, I was using Balsamic and something about you were trying to get versioning working.
That was it,
yeah. Quite work it out, right? Mm-hmm. So now the guys from Balsamic were like, can you please send this link to Marcus? Because he needs to understand, you know, that we do support. They were serious, you know, that we do support versioning and he just needs to, you know, pay attention. So I've got a link to send you.
It wasn't me. It was Lee was doing the work and I was just having a look at what he'd done. And he said, I wonder if it supports versioning. You say these things and they get taken out of context. And it goes, you know, up the chain and people come back making out I'm a bit silly.
So it's, if you're interested, it's docs.balsamic.com/cloud/alternatives. That's where it's confusing you. Because it's not actually called versioning. They call it alternatives, which I think is what they're trying to make it non-techie, aren't they?
Yeah.
But actually, I think they've made it more confusing. But the trouble is they listen to this podcast. Now they're going to take that as a criticism. Oh, no.
I was about to stand up for them and say that
actually
that is a more descriptive term. And once you've learnt it, I know you have to learn that point, but if going forward that term is used instead of versioning more and more, then that's a good thing in my view.
Yeah, versioning's I suppose it makes sense. Different versions. You don't talk about. Oh, you do talk about different alternatives.
Mm.
I've just been indoctrinated, haven't I?
Particularly, versioning suggests that it's more of a history, whereas alternatives, because you might want to go back to a previous wireframe that you'd done 10 versions ago. Oh, I use the version word. So alternatives makes more sense.
Yeah, maybe. You're right. And it's a lot more, let's be honest, it's a lot more compatible to who their main target audience is, which is, you know, ordinary people rather than people like us.
Because we're not ordinary. We're extraordinary. Or are we uncommon? I don't know. That's probably a ruder word. Weird, yeah. There you go.
Hmm. So, yeah, I mean, which brings us nicely on to what Balsamic is, which is it's a wireframing tool which has got a really low barrier to entry. And it's actually great for things like collaboration, which is what you were trying to do. It's great for discussion. It's great for testing. It's great for iteration. It's great for alternatives. And it's also a really good tool which allows teams to sell ideas. So, you know, if you want to sell an idea to your team, if you want to, you know, convince people of something, don't write a long document explaining what it is that you want. Create a little prototype. It's quick. It's easy. It's easier to do often than writing a document, and it causes less misunderstanding. In fact, I would claim that Balsamic is easier to use than pen and paper because it's just drag and drop different items that you want. So instead of having to draw a whole calendar thing, you just drag a calendar thing onto the screen. Also, Balsamic is crap in the sense that, well, it doesn't look fancy, right? Yeah. You know, some of these high-end, you know, prototyping tools, they look so nice. So when you do usability testing with them, everybody's slightly afraid to say, oh, no, that's really rubbish, because it looks like a lot of work's gone into it. Well, if you keep it looking crap, then people are happier to say, oh, no, I don't like that very much. So I think they're very clever in what they've done and really thought through who their audience is, how people respond to wireframes. Spot on, guys. I've got so much respect for them.
I really agree with that point about the looking crap, because even if you do wireframes that where everything lines up and it uses, I don't know, Arial font or something. I've had testers say, oh, I really like the different greys and things like that. And
yeah.
So,
one of two things are happening there. Either they're lying to you, you know, they're saying, oh, yeah, it's really nice. Or alternatively, they're just not getting what it is. Or exactly. Both, you know?
Yes.
So, yeah. Anyway, you could get 30-day free trial of Balsamiq. If you then like it, if you go, you know, this is great, I really like it, then when you sign up, use the code BOAGWORLD alongside your billing information. You'll get 3 months for free before they start billing you, which is amazing. So you can get that by going to balsamiq.cloud. I should also say the whole of next season, whether they sponsor or not, and again, I'm even more embarrassed to go back to them, and I'll tell you why. Because I asked them to sponsor next season, the whole season is based on a course they've already sponsored. So they'll be sponsoring the same content twice, which is probably taking the piss, isn't it?
You should be in government, Paul. You know, taxing people twice and all that kind of thing. You'd do really
I could just give them the season for free, couldn't I? That would be the nice thing to do.
Yes.
Shall I do that? What do you reckon? I've got to now. I've said it on the show.
No skin off my nose, Paul. Yeah, do it.
No. Oh, yeah. You're lucky you are. I keep forgetting I don't work for Headscape anymore. Right. Okay. On that bombshell of me losing half my revenue for next season, let's wrap up the show with a joke.
Okay. This is a joke from Francis Barton. On the BOAG World Slack channel. I hate it when people put dartboards on the ceiling. They make me want to throw up.
Oh, no. I really like that one. I don't know why that really appeals to me. That's brilliant. Who is that? Someone from the Slack channel, did you say?
Yep, Francis. Francis Barton.
Francis. Thank you, Francis. That's a really good one to end the season on. I think it's my mood. I'm like an overexcited school kid at the moment. I don't know why. There you go. Okay, so thank you very much for joining us this season. Really hope you enjoyed it. Hope you got as much out of it as we did. Thank you to the sponsors for supporting the show. Thank you to all of the guests that have come on the show. I couldn't have won this Oscar without you. It turned into an acceptance speech, so I thought I'd go with it. Thanks to my mum and dad. Thanks particularly to my wife for no longer transcribing the show so I can be rude about her. Thanks to everyone at Headscape. And we'll see you again on August the 16th. Thank you very much for listening. And goodbye.
Bye. Bye.
Oh, my God.